Greetings. It's 11 o'clock at night, Thursday, April 13th, 2017. 2 days ago, I came in an hour late for a lecture on the books coming out of the ground. And I'm not even going to do the introduction on this show. Yes, you hear it in the background. I'm watching some animal show where lions are ganging up on people and everything. And there is a sinister man approaching a girl that just got out of a lion attack alive, who's being accosted and told that the whole world might hang on her coming with him. Well, if you think that's ridiculous, listen to this. You've got Jackson Snyder Presents, and the show is entitled Books Out of the Ground. Boom, ba, boom, boom, boom. One thing I like about this show, though, is that the hero, his name is Jackson. So every time somebody says Jackson on the television, of course I'm going to look up. And, you know, I'm not really a very brave man, but I'm kind of trying to identify with this Jackson, who is an expert in animals and trying to figure out why lions are attacking all over the world. It's helping my self-esteem. It's helping me a lot in that way. And, well, Bogdan was just here a little bit ago, and I imagine a show like this, where there was a great hero that knew a lot about everything and the whole world was in danger, and the protagonist of the program's name was Bogdan. Very, very unlikely. Oh my goodness. All of a sudden, up on the screen, it says Slovenia. I know Bogdan's mother was born in Slovenia. He should really be here listening to this. Next thing you know, somebody's going to be calling out for Bogdan on the television here. This thing with animals that are going wild. And not only that, but some kind of foreign undercover nonsense. All right, I'm done. Here's the show, Out of the Ground.
I've been away from you a long time. I never thought I'd miss you so. Somehow I feel your love is real. Near you I want to be. The birds are singing, it is song time. The banjo's strumming soft and low. I know that you yearn for me too. Swanee, you're calling me. Swanee, how I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks in D-I-X. I even know my mammy's waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north won't see me no more when I get to that Swanee shore. I love the old folks at home, Swanee. How I love you, how I love you, my dear old Swanee. I'd give the world to be among the folks in D-I-X. I even know my mammy's waiting for me, praying for me down by the Swanee. The folks up north won't see me no more when I get to that Swanee.
That Eddie Kenner, something else, Annie.
We can go back to 1874 when a most exciting text came out of the ground. And that text was what's called now primarily the Didache, or the Teaching of the Twelve. You already know something about that because I'm sure that you've all looked into that before. It's a manual that helps a new Talmid and a new Mivaker, that is a new disciple and a new overseer, to know what their responsibilities are. And they're laid out in very simple terms. For instance, in the Didache, you find, for instance, the model prayer, I guess we would call it. I was going to say the Lord's Prayer. I was going to try to avoid that. But the Lord's Prayer is in there, along with an admonition for the new disciple to say that prayer three times a day. Plus, there is a, communion order of service that is very, very ancient. It's got to go back to the First Assembly. There's no mysticism in it at all. It talks primarily about the vine of David is where the wine comes from, and the bread that was scattered into the water coming together again as the whole loaf one more time. Also in the Didache are different rules of hospitality. Hospitality is very important. That is to say, how long an evangelist can stay, or a prophet. And if the prophet prophesies for certain things, like, for instance, silver, or that a table be laid before him, then that prophet is a Nevi'im, a false prophet, and they should be put out of the house. It also talks about visitors coming in, and if they want to stay 2 days, well, that's okay. Give them whatever they want. The third day, though, they have to make a decision as to whether they're going to stay on for good or not, and if they decide to stay on for good, then the host is supposed to help them get a job. There's a lot of Torah in there as well. And the, I guess, the most conservative of the liberal scholars say that this work dates somewhere around 45, which means it might date quite a bit earlier. And the way we understand it, the way it's used in the Church Fathers and other literature that's very early, is like it was written by the brother of Yahshua, Shimon bar Cleopas. Now, brother or cousin, we understand, many of us, that this was a writing that came right out of the First Assembly. Another writing that is very connected with this is the Clementines, or what I call the Nazarene Acts, because we get a picture of the type of assemblies, the type of doctrine, and really the type of history that the Didache, or the teaching of the 12, would fit perfectly. In the Nazarene Acts, we find Clement of Rome, who the Catholics say are their first pope, or second pope, or fourth pope, following at the instruction of James the Just, Kepha, or Peter, along on his journeys from Jerusalem to Tripolis, which is in, this Tripolis is in Turkey, and then on to Rome. And what is happening as Peter goes along is that he is like a Billy Graham phenomena. That wherever he goes, his wit is so sharp, his means of evangelism so full of wisdom, that people are drawn by the Holy Spirit to him in droves. And we have seen that in the modern day through Alexander Dowie at the beginning of the 20th century, and several others right on up to Catherine Kuhlman and A.A. Allen and some others in our time, where throngs of people will come. There's no reason to disbelieve it. But in Peter's journeys, assemblies were being made so fast that on the spot, Peter, Kepha, had to assign a mevaker or an overseer to the assembly. Whether they had the relevant experience or not, he had to use spiritual discernment to pick someone out. And there needed to be some kind of book of instruction for such people, the new overseer, the new Talmid or disciple. And the Didache fills the bill for both of those things. And so there is a real relationship between these two books. Now, the Clementines or the Nazarene Acts were hidden in plain sight for years and years and years, hidden in plain sight in the eighth book of the Apostolic Fathers, hidden in there and declared to be a novel. But since we came out with a new edition of this back in 2007, I think thousands of people have read it, and it's changed people's lives. I've had the testimonies of that. They have a different viewpoint, not from the Petrine viewpoint of the Acts of the Apostles, or I should say from the Pauline view of Acts of the Apostles, like Luke is, but from the Petrine, from the Acts of Peter and on through his travels. The book is novelistic, but at the same time, the book is full of early beliefs and understandings, apostolic understandings that have never popped up really anywhere before. Now, my experience with that book, I discovered about 1990 when I got my two-volume set of New Testament Apocrypha. Now, the Clementines or Nazarene Acts are quite long. So what they put in the Apocrypha was just a very short snatch of these things, the very beginning of it, just to get you into it. And a little later on, And so it was so intriguing when I read it that I had to find it. And in those days, you know, this was soon after Al Gore invented the internet. You couldn't just go on the internet and find this thing. You had to go to some theological library. And this was what I did. I went to a theological library. I had to get a sponsor to get this book out, a university professor with tenure. And he got me the book out of one of the Florida libraries. And then I copied it off immediately, OCR'd it, and then got the Latin part of it and began to go through it. And it took several years to give you a new rendition of the Clementines, or as they say, pseudo-Clementines. However, it was worth the effort. And you know, I can't remember any of it except the story behind it. I cannot remember doing it. I passed the manuscript on to Theodore Dornan and then to Chris Plourd for editing. And then in the second edition, we added the Arabic version of it and some of the Clementine homilies to it. And I'm thinking right now, maybe I should do an audio version of that. It'd be a big job, but it would be worth it. You find in there doctrines like the standing man doctrine. You might recall Jonadab in the Bible, a companion of King Jehu, if I got that right, King Jehu. And Jonadab, grandfather, was named Rechab. And Rechab made a vow to Yahweh that his family would always keep the old ways, that they wouldn't touch any wine, that they wouldn't build any houses, but that they would stay as nomadics and keep up the traditions of Abraham. So by Jonadab's time, he continued to bring his family into the old ways. And it was said to him by Yahweh through the prophet, you will always have someone standing before me. We understand on behalf of the family. This was what they call Yeshua HaMashiach in the Clementines or Nazarene Acts, the standing man. And the doctrine there is explained. So this is something that had never come up before. And you might remember Pinchas or Phineas, who did an act that we would normally say was very sinful in actually murdering an Ezraite priest and his concubine, I think from Moab, or his wife. And because of Phineas' zeal, important word, zeal for the house has consumed me. Because of Phineas' zeal, Yahweh says, you will always have a man standing before me. So we have this standing man doctrine and almost a priesthood that goes with it. There's another doctrine in there called the true prophet doctrine. The true prophet doctrine is that if you are a prophet, everything that you predict is going to come true. There is no use arguing with it because you are the Navi Emet, the true prophet. And this is another title for Yeshua HaMashiach throughout that book, the Navi Emet. Also in the Nazarene Acts, there is the one story that we like to kind of point to over and over again, that is Saul and his men on the steps of the temple attacking James. He has a gang of hoods, and they come up to James teaching on the steps of the temple. He's got a multitude there he's teaching, and it's right before they're going to be baptized. All these Talmudim. When who's called my enemy comes forth and tries to raise a rabble there, and he forms an example by taking up a brand. I think that's like a metal fire poker. And he starts beating the Talmudim there. And it is said that there were many more beaten than were beating. And if they wanted to, those who were beaten could have easily overcome the beaters. But for the sake of sparing lives and the sake of love, I suppose, they just took it. And Paul himself assaults James and throws him down the temple steps, leaving him there at the bottom dead, as though he were dead anyway, with broken legs. That's just some of the intrigue. Later on, there's many debates with Simon Magus, who in this book, it's understood that Simon Magus was the third man in charge of the John the Baptist group. Okay, there was John the Baptist. His second man was Dositheus. Prince. His third man was Simon Magus. Of course, he wasn't called Magus at that time. He called himself Shimon El Elyon, Shimon the Greatest God, so to speak. When John the Baptist died, Simon and Dositheus came into conflict, and Simon was so devious in his words and wise in an evil way that he shamed Dositheus, and Dositheus went into obscurity and died. So that left Simon Magus to be the head of the John the Baptist movement. And you might not recognize this, but the John the Baptist movement is still alive today. What's the name of it now? Masbuthians or Nazareans or something in Iraq? I can't remember right now. I know Jason knows. What is it, Jason?
Mandaeans.
Mandaeans. Why aren't you teaching this? Mandaeans. You're perfectly capable.
Someday soon.
All right, good. We'll count on that. Another book of some importance, this book was, well, of great importance, was in the canon. Well, at least the loose canon of Scripture before the Nicene Council and the Constantinople Councils of the 4th century. And that is one I think is one of the most astounding books that has come out of the ground. This also has been hidden away as Apocrypha in the Church Fathers for a long time and was disparaged a lot for two reasons. One, because the Catholics used it to prove that Sunday was the true Sabbath, but they also rejected it because the last several chapters are nothing but Torah, one upon another commandment. So what we have here is a book that I think its greatest knowledge imparted is the knowledge of when this second coming is supposed to happen. In this book, the writer is evidently Barnabas. He is trying to rally whoever's left of the movement after the destruction of Jerusalem. You know, literally millions in that war were killed or taken off into slavery. And afterwards, whoever was left, they had to try to reform. And we find this Barnabas calling these people my little children and trying to bring the movement back together again. The high point of the book, to me, is that he identifies himself as being, in one way or the other, as being in the fifth millennia of the seven millennias of salvation history. And he predicts in his way, and some might interpret it different, that the thing will start anew in the seventh millennium, 2,000 years from then. And as I try never to fail to remind people, this is that millennium. And I have been teaching for years, long before this millennia, that it's very possible that this is the millennia since, say, about 1996, and that we're moving into it. And you and I, I'm afraid, we're never going to see the big fruits of it any more than the disciples and the apostles saw the fruits of their labors at the beginning and middle of the first century or the fifth millennium. Any more than we will now, we're 17 years or maybe 21 or 22 years into the seventh millennium. All we can do now is make people aware, set the stage, pour and cure the concrete for what's to happen next. We're the forerunners here. If these books popping out of the ground and out of obscurity mean anything today or say anything to us today, they're telling us that our time is the time to set the theme for the rest of this millennium. That is awesome, awesome, awesome. And we get the Dead Sea Scrolls. These books literally did pop out of the ground. I got emails this week asking me, please tell me where that passage is in the Dead Sea Scrolls that talks about the books popping out of the ground. I have to tell you something. I read it in the Dead Sea Scrolls, probably in 2014, 2013. I marked it, I highlighted it, I read it again, and I have never since been able to find it. Isn't that something? I mean, I'm not making it up. How many here believe me to be a liar? Just Allison. Okay, one person. I'm not lying. I read it, I marked it, and marked it. Maybe it wasn't in the scrolls, but there is a text Enoch 103 that somebody brought to my mind, maybe Stephanie, some time ago. I can't remember who it was, but I don't have my Enoch here. I'm in the secret room right now. I'm in the bunker. I don't know what's outside this door. Oh, let me go see if the coast is clear yet. 1 minute. The coast was clear. Some of you know what's going on here right now. I was late because of it. Please forgive me. Enoch 103, I don't have it here. Maybe somebody has it real quick. I don't know. Go take a look. But there's some talk about things coming out of the ground. Very similar, but it's not the same. However, maybe it's just prophetic. Let's look at it this way. Suppose there is a passage that talks about the books that come out of the ground. And the passage went on to say, when they come up, when they're exposed, the Essene movement, or what we call Essenes, would begin again, the Zadokite movement. Actually, these scrolls really didn't come out of the ground till about 1993. Yes, I know they were dug up 47 to 56, something like that. But they were not allowed out, primarily by the scholars that had hold of them, which amounted to all Roman Catholics, mainly priests and monastics. There was one Methodist, but when he read the scrolls, he became an atheist. Who was that? Anybody remember? Very strange character. He also came up with the Shapiro strips, the oldest Torah ever found. How about John Marco Allegro? Okay. John Marco Allegro. That's another story. I don't know what that noise is, but somebody's under the hairdryer, I think. Did you find it, Yaz Lion? Joshua, did you find 103?
I'm in 103.
Why don't you read it off? Can you?
I can, but I haven't found the books coming out of the ground yet. It does talk about the books from the Shamayim. You want me to read the whole 103?
Why not?
Okay. Now, therefore, I swear to you, the righteous, by the esteem of the great and honored and El Shaddai in dominion, and by his greatness, I swear to you. I know a mystery and have read the tablets of the Shamayim and have seen the Kodesh books and have found the writing in them and written regarding them, that all goodness and joy and esteem are prepared for them and written down for the spirits of those who have died in righteousness, and that much good shall be given to you in reward for your labors, and that your lot is abundantly beyond the lot of the living, and the spirits of you who died in righteousness shall live and rejoice, and their spirits shall not perish, nor their remembrance from before the face of the great one unto all the generations of the world. Therefore no longer fear their revilings. Woe to you, you sinners, when you have died, if you die in the wealth of your sins, and those who are like you say regarding you, Baruch are the sinners, or blessed are the sinners. They have seen all their days, and now and how they have died in prosperity and in wealth, and have not seen tribulation or murder in their life, and they have died in honor, and judgment has not been executed on them during their life. Now that their beings will be made to descend into the grave, and they shall be wretched in their great tribulation, and into darkness and chains, and a burning flame, where there is grievous judgment, your spirit shall enter, and the great judgment shall be for all the generations of the world. Woe to you, for you shall have no peace, and do not say in regard to the righteous and good who are in life. In our troubled days we have toiled laboriously and experienced every trouble and met with much evil and been consumed and have become few and our spirit small. And we have been destroyed and have not found any help us even with a word. We have been tortured and destroyed and not hope to see life from day to day. We hope to be the head and have become the tail. We have toiled laboriously and had no satisfaction in our toil. And we have become the food of the sinners and the unrighteous. And they have laid their yoke heavily upon us. They have had dominion over us and hated us and smote us. And to those that hated us, we have bowed our necks, but they did not pity us. We desired to get away from them that we might escape and be at rest, and found no place where we should flee and be safe from them. And we complained to the rulers in our tribulation and cried out against those who devoured us, but they did not attend to our cries and would not hear our voice. And they helped those who robbed us and devoured us and those who made us few. And they concealed their oppression, and they did not remove from us the yoke of those that devoured us and dispersed us and murdered us. And they concealed their murder and did not remember that they had lifted up their hands against us. That's actually a pretty good part to read, huh?
Well, I think that about ends up the book, doesn't it? There might be another
It goes to 104. Yeah. Well, you know, it goes further to 105.
Just a couple more. Yeah. Notice in that reading, it was a good reading, Josh. How the dead are personified. They're called dead in the first place, yet they are brought alive by the author in order to primarily cry out in vengeance against those that used them when they were alive. They even say, now we have no part in life. It's very similar to Revelation, where we have the souls, I think it's six, souls crying out from under the altar. Isn't that about the fifth seal, I think? Souls crying out from under the altar. They're dead, but they're personified as being alive and crying out. You know, death means death. It doesn't mean life. If death and life were the same, then everybody would have eternal life, right? In one place or the other. There are just constant threats against these people that they could not take vengeance on them in life, so they will take vengeance on them later on. And then we see the same vision again coming up. I don't know, I think in Revelation, is it 14, where we have all of a sudden the 144,000 that were dead. They all died. People today say, I want to be part of the 144,000. Well, get ready to die a wretched death, if that's what you want, if you think it's going to happen. They come back with Messiah. He's on a horse and comes down to Mount Zion. What are they there to do? The dead come back to fight, the ones that are sealed. Then we have in that same chapter, I think it's Revelation 7, we got 144,000, then we got multitudes crying out, sozo, save, salvation. Maybe they're crying out, Yeshua, they're hauling palm branches. And you find them later on in the chapter 2, kind of like standing by and cheering of all nations, tongues, and types, of course. Yes, Revelation 6. Thank you, Professor Smith. So we're getting correlation between these books. Revelation is almost a remake of Zechariah, the prophet. And, of course, this is at a time when I want to tell you the difference between a prophecy and apocalypse right now. The main difference is a prophecy is, thus saith the Lord, or thus saith Yahweh. And apocalypse has prediction-like stories in it where there's always an angel guide. Apocalypse talks about the present in symbolic terms. So only those who are initiated into the symbols can understand what they're talking about. Whereas a prophecy talks about the future. And that's the difference between apocalypse and prophecy. One tells the present history. One tells the past, or I should say the past from the future to the future. People say, well, apocalypses also tell the future. Yes, there's parts of prophetic language in there, but understand they're primarily telling us, Revelation's primarily telling us about the war with the Romans, and Daniel's primarily telling us about the war with the Greeks, and Second Esdras is primarily telling us again the war of the Romans, first or second revolt, I'm not sure. Whereas prophets like Hosea, Amos, Joel, those guys are talking about Israel specifically, not the whole world, and what is bound to happen. I was always amazed, I'm off subject, but look at the prophecy between Isaiah about 10 and 19, and apply that prophecy to what has been happening in the world right up to 19, the things that are happening right now. The best way to find the place for the prophecy is to find the historic situation that it fits. That is, the internal evidence of the prophecy will tell you where it fits and whether it fulfills itself or not. Notice at the end of apocalypses, like Revelation and Daniel, there's always great news at the end. Israel always wins. Messiah always comes. It's a great battles, and the enemy is scattered. Yet, in both cases, Daniel and Revelation, that wasn't the way it ended, unless it ended that way, evidently, in the other dimensions, because we see the heavenly horsemen and so forth coming, or the angels in Daniel, they're coming to give great predictions. They have to fight angels and princes in the air, and it's just a marvelous spectacle in the air, while on earth there's war and usually defeat. What about our day? talking about books that's coming out of the ground, Liz and I were looking at a book this week. It's called, and I just recorded, it's Ida J.S. Presents, The Epistle of Titus to His Disciples on the Matter of Chastity. The whole book is a tribute to women, but not a nice tribute. It gives you the impression that women cannot be disciples. This is a pseudepigraph, of course. Ouch. I'd like to bring that up here, Professor Smith, in just a minute. That the true disciple, that is a man, is to be chaste and not even look at a woman, nor come near a woman, nor ever get married. And the writer of that epistle, whether it be Titus or not, probably not, uses scriptures galore from every place that he, for pretexts as to why men are not supposed to be hooked up with women at all. There is also the text we were looking at called The Acts of Paul and Thecla. Maybe you've heard of this one. It's on a similar vein, only there's a story here. And that is, Thecla is a young girl that falls in love with Paul. And Thecla is fiancé.
I don't know if anyone else is experiencing issues with your audio, but I can't hear you all that well, sir.
How about now?
Much better. And now it's muted.
Try now.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. See? This is the Blue Nessie. You like it? Uh-huh. Watch this. What does it remind you of? My phone's ringing. Hey, I'm online right now. Let me call you right back in a little bit, okay? All right. I'll call you later. Oh, let's see. Thecla. It was the custom to marry a man 10 years older, at least, at that time, because the girls, they wanted to get them early and with an older man so they wouldn't stray, you see. That was the idea. And so they would be married at 12 to 15, usually, about that age. So Thecla listens to Paul preaching in the next room, and she falls in love with him. And Paul, of course, is preaching chastity. Stay away from women, you men, and you girls. Just kind of opposite of Titus, who preaches to men. He preaches to girls. You stay away from men, they'll corrupt you, et cetera, et cetera. So she is engaged to an older man, and she breaks her engagement and runs off after Paul. She runs off after Paul. And, of course, she ends up in the lion's den and it's a good thing in the lion's den. You see, when they traveled together, a lion came after them. But Paul was able to talk the lion into getting saved and baptized. And it just so happens that when Thecla got in the lion's den, it happened to be that lion that was saved. So the lion protected her, and she kept from death time after time through not only the machinations of Paul.
You sound like a robot again.
Oh, I don't know what to do. I sound like a robot.
You got kicked off?
I'm back on now. You'll be happy to know. Let's talk about a couple other books. Both made the canon at one time or the other, but they've pretty much gone into obscurity. But they were so very influential, especially through the Catholic faith and now in the church. Even though they're not read much anymore, they're still very influential. They're called The Apocalypse of Peter and The Apocalypse of Paul. I think that's right. They're both stories of journeys. You know how Enoch is taken on journeys through the various heavens, especially in the second book of Enoch. If you never read Second Enoch, it's a story of journeys. Up seven, up 10 heavens, all the things that he's seeing there. This is the same thing, only one of them, the Apocalypse of Peter, is with Peter, going up, 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 and down, 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 and the other's with Paul. They both have similar messages, and that primarily is that in hell, there are many different layers and punishments. Like, actually, the Epistle of Titus I mentioned before talks about some of these same punishments that's out of the Apocalypse of Paul. You're taking on these journeys, and you've got women that seduced good believing men, nailed up by their breasts,
nailed up by their hands, men and women nailed up by their feet and hanging down with their heads in manure. All kinds of horrible punishments depending on what you did. I can't name them right off. Of course, your ears are too sensitive to hear some of these. They're so terrible. Apocalypse of Peter, Apocalypse of Paul. Yes, they were both in the proto-canon and both sent out. And Professor Smith adds, yes, Dante Alighieri, his, they call it Dante's Inferno. I have a copy of it here out on JS Presents. You can listen to some of it. It mostly deals with, Greek gods and Greek politicians that have gone to the underworld when they died and all the horrible things that's happened to them. Very, very similar from the Acts of Peter and the Apocalypse of Peter and the Apocalypse of Paul, different levels of hell. Honestly, they're not worth reading because there's absolutely no truth to it. No truth to it. If there was truth to it, Messiah would have said that when a person is dead, they're still alive. Messiah talks about death and resurrection. He never talks about the eternal soul going anyplace. The only place bad he talks about is the body ending up on the Jerusalem trash heap, Gehenna, which, of course, the fire never was quenched. The worms never ceased to be. You've heard me tell before when I was a boy, one of the things that excited me to try to find out truth and get educated in these matters was that I endured service after service of hellfire and brimstone sermons that always ended up the same way when I was a child. If you died tonight, are you sure you would go to heaven? That would bring us kids right up to the altar, praying, crying, begging God not to kill us tonight. Because they didn't really believe in the devil. You know, what they primarily believed in was God killed people. And he does. He does. But he's not going to kill you, certainly. Not going to kill you. You don't deserve that. But I think that set me on a life's course, really, as a child. I looked through my New Testament, even though it was the King James Version, and I never saw that. And then later on, I found out those passages about hell were put in. They are not original to the text any more than the horrors of the Apocalypse of Peter, the Apocalypse of Paul have any truth to them. When a person dies, they die and await the resurrection. Except Yahshua says, if you believe my words and in the one who sent me, you never die. I believe that too. I'm hoping that I will never die. I hope it's the same with you. But right now, we're just speculating. You say, well, I'm saved and I know that I am. You don't know any such thing. I'm sorry. You don't know anything. You don't know. You're not supposed to know. Are you supposed to have that much assurance? I've had people come to me time after time. Why don't I have assurance that I'm going to heaven when I die? Well, I would like to shock them and say, well, you're not. You're not going to heaven. That's not what it's all about. If you're justified by believing in Yahshua HaMashiach and the one that sent him, and you, I'm going to add to that, in order to believe in them, you've got to do what they say. If you do, he promises you'll never die. He promises the rest that everybody else will die and then be resurrected to the judgment, those who are good to life. Those who are evil, to a judgment of a trial. A trial. A trial. Put your King James Version away. You language guys, look at the Greek there and see what it says. Everybody gets a trial. They're judged by judges that cannot fail, that know everything about one's life from beginning to end and everything that went on in the womb. Off the subject. Preaching just a little bit. Just a little bit. There's another book I want to mention here that I'm getting particularly excited about right now because I believe that I have someone, she's online right now, that's going to want to record this for me. There's a book that's been hidden away, even though it is acknowledged as an early Christian text, even though the original is in Aramaic. What they're talking about is Jewish Christian. It's called the Odes of Solomon. Odes of Solomon. Obviously, reading the first page, you know that Solomon didn't write these things. They're not mentioned anywhere
And any early historian or philosopher, they're only mentioned after Messiah came. When I first read them, I thought immediately, these Odes of Solomon were not written by a man. No man could write these kind of words, so passionate, so full of femininity, pathos, and divine, drippy, gooey love. So I'm assuming that a woman wrote that. And then I read in an apocryphal work called Pistis Sophia, there is the sister of Yeshua singing her odes and quoted in the Pistis Sophia as Shalome, the sister, singing one of the odes. And then all of a sudden it came to me, Solomon, Odes of Solomon. Somebody has switched this around and put the masculine name on there when it should be Shalome. And that Shalome is referenced as the singer of these songs. So I got to work and retranslated this book, Odes of Solomon. Now it's Odes of Shalome. And I gave it a new name. A kind of a name that would kind of make a person interested in reading them. Let's see. Songs, Netzari Songs of Extraterrestrial Love. You have it? I just ordered a couple too. Good for you. And I don't know, a couple weeks ago, I read some out of it, but it should be read in a very dramatic woman's voice. And Miss Harrison is going to give it a try, I hope. Yes, yes, I just sent her copy out. Shalome, Shalome. Oh, the Pistis Sophia talks about Shalome's house being open to the master, that he would come and rest himself on the couch or sit or recline at her table, and they would talk about discipleship. And Shalome, the sister, says, I am your disciple, am I not? And her purported brother says to her, learn my wisdom. It's just a beautiful story. The whole Pistis Sophia, though being very Gnostic, is a beautiful story. And the odes are love poems. I just love them. And I've set them up, kept keeping the Aramaicisms in there. You know, in Aramaic, there's the name, Maria. Maria is the Aramaic of Miriam. Maria is also used in place of the sacred name. Mar means master. Yah is Yahweh. Maria. So when they use the sacred name in Aramaic, in the Aramaic scriptures, it's always Maria. Very interesting. Maria, the name. In Jesus' family tomb, we find Maria in there. And we find Mariamene, He, Mara. Mara, the feminine of Mar, the master. I like to say the mistress, but nobody ever understands that for what it means. They think she's somebody's concubine, all right? That's a master teacher. Mary Magdalene had a tremendous reputation that's annotated in the Egyptian scriptures for being a tremendous healer and teacher. Sometime, if you get a chance, listen to the story of the Acts of Philip, who was her brother. You find that out. I am going to put a link on here.
Hey, brother.
Yes, sir.
Have you seen the new discovery over at St. Mary's Cathedral?
What is that?
The St. Mary Church. They were renovating it, and they moved something out of a corner of a wall, and they saw a type of a statue of a woman, and they think it's Mary Magdalene.
St. Mary's Cathedral, where's that?
Oh, I don't remember. I was just saw it on the news feed and was like, that's pretty cool. I should tell Jackson about it.
Absolutely. Look it up for me, all right? Or I'll try to look for it. I've been so busy lately, you can't even imagine.
I'll find it real quick.
Huh?
I'll find it real quick.
Okay. Here's a link to the Acts of Philip redone by myself, and it'll give you an idea of Mary Magdalene's place in the economy of Yahweh in her time. I'll tell you why. I think that this is primarily historical material because in 2011, Mary Magdalene's sister or brother was Philip, the evangelist, and you know, in Greek, Mary Magdalene's name is Mariamene, named after the Maccabean princess, Mariamene. And so we find in 2011 the burial place of Philip the Evangelist in the very place that this story says he is in. That tomb has been found. Now, the bones haven't been found because they haven't read the story well enough, because the story tells you exactly where his bones are. It's our secret there, Alice and Gary. It's our big secret. We're not telling. No way. When all those professors call us and want to know, we're not going to tell them. Someday we're going to get over to, what's the name of that place? Hierapolis. And we'll go dig up those bones. All we have to do is look for the snake pit. Amen. Let me take a look at some of this stuff on chat, if anything. Odes of Shemalome. I like that idea. Treating one another is what passes into the next. I definitely... You know, he's going to know everything about us, the great white judgment, great white throne judgment. Hey, the truth is, if we follow the guidelines of John 5, 20 and following, we're not going to be there unless we're judges. The dead know nothing. I bet that's from Ecclesiastes. Is it? Yeah. Oh, soul sleep. Soul sleep. Oh, yes, yes, yes. We could talk about that, but our time's up here. All I want to say is that, have we ever addressed that before? I'm going to ask my understudy here. We're not addressed soul sleep? Okay.
No, very briefly, maybe here and there, but not directly. That's not been a complete topic. It might be really good. I know we did it in the Earth Course.
In the Air Force?
Earth Course. Sorry.
Earth Course. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to redo the Earth Course so it's easier, just as soon as I can. I want to tell you what I've been working on, a couple of things, since I know I owe everybody phone calls and this and that. Bad souls are burnt up slowly. You know, Charles Taze Russell, who won accredited with starting Jehovah's Witness, would have never agreed with that. Never, never, never. Read his book. See, what's it called? Divine Plan of the Ages? Man, is that a good book? And you think, oh, I'm reading Jehovah Witness literature. No, they don't believe that anymore. They want everybody burned up. He didn't believe that. Charles Taze Russell believes just like I do. We're going to have a white throne judgment. And it's going to be equitable judgment. Even the evil may have a place.
Found it for you.
Okay, read it all.
It is in Newport, Rhode Island. It was uncovered recently at St. Mary's Church, Rhode Island's oldest Roman Catholic parish. When the church's organ was removed from the choir loft for refurbishment, a sculpture of a woman's head was revealed in half of the face at each end of an arch that spans the 1848 church building.
Leave it to those Catholics. They find something else. Oh, I can't wait to read that. Does it show a picture or anything?
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at it right now.
Ship me a link, will you, please?
Sure. Not a problem.
Save me another 5 seconds. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get the Jihad chartered in Florida. And the difficulty with that is you can't ever find the forms or any direction. You can get people to do it for you for thousands of dollars. Not talking about the IRS. I'm just talking about you got to get certified as a entity in a state before you can do that. So finally, I found a form, but it was for incorporating. I thought that's going to be pretty close. I already written all the charter documents for the Ahad. You see, we want to be legitimate completely. However, after writing to the Florida Secretary of State and 18 other people in the Florida government, guess what? I got an encrypted reply today. You know what the reply said? It said, call me at this number tomorrow. I'll talk to you. That's all it said. That's good, because I'm ready for them. I've got scads of paperwork ready to go. Now, I'm going to take up an offering, because it's going to cost you money, my friend. Many pesos for you to become chartered in Florida. Yes. You are a citizen of the United States. We don't have no citizen down here in Florida government. We are all Cuban. I see a Cuban in the corner right over there. Right over there. I see a Cuban in the corner sneaking around.
We all are illegal Cuban here. And if you want to be chartered in Florida, then I suggest you go to University of Cuba, give up your citizenship, go to Sargasso Sea, take a sea trip, 15 minutes with a monkey, pull out 3 teeth, and then eat a horse. I hope not. I hope this is legitimate. Gee whiz. Life is fun, isn't it? You're such a good audience. Sorry I was late. It's 11 o'clock now. I'm going to leave you go. And with my love and concern, keep those letters and checks rolling in. All right. Good night.
Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep...
That's not all there is. You see, I usually put a fancy ending on these things, but I lost my hard drive here someplace. So what I'm just going to have to do is wing it right now and say good night. Love you all. Thank you for tuning in.